Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. There is so much here that is symptomatic of what Wesley Smith has called a culture of death. So much here that is symptomatic. And this, the most shocking and sad thing about this conversation as we talk about euthanasia and assisted suicide is that this is not the end of the road. The culture of death does not have as its goal assisted suicide or euthanasia. That is just a stepping stone to something else. And we'll try in the course of this hour's conversation with Wesley to find out what that something else might be. Feel free to give us a call. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers in this hour will receive a copy of Wesley Smith's book called Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope, From Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. 1-800-730-2727. You can post a question or a comment also on our Issues Etc. forum. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find the Issues Etc. forum. They're waiting for your questions and your comments. Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide and author of the book, several books, but one is Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. Wesley, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's go to the phones. Winnie is calling from St. Louis. Winnie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Yes, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I have a handy little ear piece, and I'm working in my room, cleaning my closet, and listening to you guys. And I just wanted to share a couple of things. Not to sound too theological, I give you a little background. I'm about 48, I have to admit, and I have seven kids, and I'm a nurse, and my mom died of Lou Gehrig's. And I also have a lot of brothers and sisters. I mean gobs of brothers and sisters. So I kind of grew up in a group. And I think I'm just real sensitive to this issue of the real rubber meeting the road, and you see someone and you wonder, the poor thing is suffering so. Why not pull the plug? And I just want to share a couple of things that I've learned. Since I was 19, I was born again. And the distance from my heart to my head, God himself is helping me with as I look at his word. And this morning, I picked up this little Jesus' little Good Manners pocketbook. It's real cute. And I was just meditating on the scriptures, little verses in there and their pictures. And one of the verses was about submitting to one another. And it's from Ephesians. It's chapter 5, verse 21. And the reason why we do that from this verse is the rest of the verse says, out of reverence for Christ. And as I was going through nursing school and going into nursing homes and seeing how I reacted to people, and as I was learning to walk with the Lord, and as I was seeing who God was, I was watching myself change towards people. And it was a heart change. In other words, a certain kind of dignity that only can come from reverence for Christ, as that verse says.
Winnie, thank you very much. Wesley, your response.
Well, it was very beautifully stated. But I also think we have to acknowledge that there are people who don't have religious beliefs who can have that same care and devotion to people who are suffering. Very briefly, my last hospice patient, as I mentioned in the earlier hour, died of Lou Gehrig's disease. He told me that he was suicidal for the first 2.5 years of his life. And the reason he was suicidal wasn't because he was growing progressively disabled, although that was very distressing, but it was because he said, and let me tell you how he put it, first my friends stopped visiting me, then my friends stopped calling me, then my friend stopped calling my wife, and I felt like a token presence in the world. In other words, this man felt abandoned. He felt that he was pushed to the side of the road. That was another way he would put it. And he grew very despairing. He said that if he could have gone to Kevorkian, he would have. But 2.5 years later, he told me, I came out of the fog. Those were the exact words he used. And he was so glad to be alive. So if we had been the so-called compassionate death with dignity type people, during those 2.5 years, we would have said, well, of course we should give him the poison. But you know what? If we had done that, we wouldn't have known it. We could never have known it. But we would have denied him what he told me were the best years of his life. I found it hard to believe. But he said, these are my best years. He said, I have never lived more intently than this. He said, look out my window. What do you see? I said, Bob, I see your backyard. He said, but you're not seeing my backyard. You're not seeing that leaf fall from the tree like I am, or the butterflies. He said, I have never lived so intensely in my life. I am so glad to be alive. I'm watching my daughters grow up. He got on the internet and started to invest and died before the dot-com bust, and he made some money for his family. He started to collect art. I mean, what would we have deprived this man of, thinking we were so compassionate? And yet you tell that story to people who support euthanasia, and they shrug their shoulders and say, well, I want it if I need it. I mean, it's almost like the only basis for wanting the euthanasia was, well, that's what I want. I have the right. I mean, it's mere assertions of belief. It doesn't deal with how real people will be affected.
1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. That's our call-in number. Marilyn is calling from San Francisco. Marilyn, welcome to Issues Etc.
I just wanted to make a comment. It's like on this subject, I kind of have mixed feelings until you brought up some of the issues. Kevorkian was sort of like a personal hero of mine, although I will say I have religious convictions, but I'm in my 40s, and I'm already struggling with disabilities of my own, and I'm taking care of a parent who is disabled, and now on the one coin, I could say that, oh, if she wanted to do that, I would beg her not to and say, gee, Ma, let's figure something out. But when she goes, I have no more family except a life partner that I'm not sure if he'd even know what to do, and neither one of us, you know, would really have the financial resources if I became that incapacitated. And I feel if I had to lose my home and everything I felt dear and had no physical quality of life, I think on the one hand, yes, I would want to have that option.
Marilyn, I want you to stay on the line. We'll get Wesley's response here, but I want you to stay on the line so that we can send you Forced Exit, this book by Wesley Smith, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. How do you respond? These are the basic concerns that I'm sure you have heard echoed again and again and again, Wesley.
Yes, and what strikes me about calls like that, and you know, my heart goes out, but to say that killing is the answer to that is to surrender to the problem and not solve it. What the woman, the caller needs, I'm sorry I didn't get her name, is inclusion, and she needs to know that she should be cared for. It seems to me one of the major jobs of the churches should be, and I don't care whether the caller is religious or not religious, but churches should make sure that people don't die alone. I mean, every church should make it one of their ministries to say that anybody in our neighborhood area, if we find somebody is dying, or make it known that if somebody's dying, that we will have people who will be their friends or who are disabled to the point where they can't get out. Because that is what is driving this. What the caller said is exactly what drives us. It isn't pain and suffering. It's a worry about being a burden, and it's a worry about being abandoned. And if we say, okay, the answer to that is killing, then we will never solve those problems.
Linda is calling from Nashville. Linda, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes. Again, I wish to state my experience with FDA-approved medicine as to why euthanasia-assisted suicide or murder. One, I was once on a benzodiazepine, transzene or clozapine for epilepsy. By 1994, I could not even tell the doctors that Clinton was president of the United States. A second argument is the patient cannot be helped. A new medicine or treatment may be found to help a patient. In 94, I was given a new anticonvulsant, which helped for a while. Then later, I had brain surgery, which has been a tremendous help so far.
Linda, thank you very much for the call. Wesley, this is one of those basic arguments, and we'll have to get to it on the other side of the break, and that is that, my condition is terminal and my condition is incurable, I imagine there are people out there right now saying, and I'm sure you're out there listening, and you say, look, that is my biggest fear. I don't fear the death so much as I fear the dying part and what leads up to it. I fear the incurable disease. I fear the pain, the loss of so many things, the financial loss and the loss of friends and family in the process. Those fears are real. And those fears ought to be acknowledged. The question is the answer to those things? Is the answer to those things death? Now, death may be at the end of the road, but is the answer death? The Germans say fear is a lousy counselor, and it is. Rather than looking at these things from the aspect of fear, say, what is it that I really deserve? Do I deserve to be killed because of these things that may happen to me in the future? Now, someone's going to say, look, someone may not be mentally capable of making these decisions. What do we do with them? We'll get the response to that. Linda's call on the other side of this break. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with Wesley Smith about euthanasia and assisted suicide.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology. The latest issue also contains articles titled, The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart, by Pastor Eric Rotman, Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos, by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay, From Evangelicalism to the Evangel. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith is our guest. We're talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. Before the break, Wesley, Linda was on the line. The first point she made had to do with the fact that there was a point in her life where the family could have been saying, look, pull the plug. She is completely out of it. She says she was completely doped up.
Yeah, and the other thing she said was, I don't want to confuse saying no to unwanted medical treatment and killing, because they're different. But the other thing was, she was able to get treatment from a situation that would have qualified her, as she described it, for euthanasia. Instead of being killed by poison, she was alive to call our radio show, your radio show and the one I'm on. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I remember during the mid-90s, I've been doing this work now, Todd, for 10 years. It's amazing to me that I've been doing it this long. I never intended it. I never intended to do more than write one article. And now I'm books into it, and I'm 1,000 talk shows into it, and I'm speaking internationally, because the issue is so profound and important, and it is so hard to get people to hear it and see it and look and see. You know, evil is hardest to see in its own time. It's easy to look back on slavery and see it, but there were a lot of people back then who didn't see it. There were people back in the mid-90s when AIDS was at its worst in San Francisco, and I moved up here in 92. And you would walk down the street in 92, 93, 94, and it was a tragedy almost every block. You'd see people who you could tell were in their 20s or 30s, but who looked like they were 70, 80, who were dying, who were emaciated from this horrible disease, people on canes, people being supported. And there was an entire assisted suicide subculture that developed in the Castro, which is the gay area of San Francisco. And there were stories in the papers about how these people were taking control of their lives, and instead of letting AIDS do it to them, they were going to take control and defeat death by killing themselves, which is part of the ideology at work here. I remember going and speaking at a public forum against euthanasia, and a doctor stood up and said he had killed AIDS patients, and he had done so because they'd gotten down to 70 pounds, and that he didn't see anything else to do to alleviate their suffering. And we talked about that for a while, and I said, you know other doctors who do it too? He said, yeah. I said, I bet they haven't waited that long, have they? He said, well, no, they haven't. And then within about a few months of that event, so basically it was what the doctors decided was a time to go, not what the patient decided. And then a few months after that, suddenly the new drugs came out. And people who were 70 pounds and on the brink of death came back, got their health back. There are people who are dead today because they had assisted suicide from friends or from physicians who would be alive today but for that subculture that destroyed their will to try to go on, and which told them that somehow by taking matters into their own hands or doctors' hands that they were defeating AIDS. But they surrendered to AIDS, and they surrendered to AIDS tragically before they would have had an opportunity to say, I'm coming back.
This is a good time, Wesley, for you to tell us about something you mentioned in the first hour, futile care theory.
Yes, this is a more immediate actual threat to all of your listeners than assisted suicide, because futile care theory is beginning to be practiced now against people against their will. Futile care theory says, and it's the rage of bioethics. We had an earlier caller who said he was appalled. I think he said he was appalled at some of the things he was hearing about from bioethics. You read about it in the New England Journal of Medicine. You read about it in the Journal of the American Medical Association, in the Hastings Center Report, which is a bioethics journal, and others. And it says that if a doctor believes that the quality, this is a subjective value judgment, that the quality of a patient's life is not worth living, then if that patient wants medical treatment other than comfort care, meaning if they want their life sustained or they want to see about trying to find cures or whatever, that the doctor has the right to unilaterally refuse that treatment based on his or her value judgments or those of bioethicists, who, by the way, as a general rule, not universally, but generally don't believe in the sanctity of human life. Gilbert Mylander, who's a Lutheran, I believe, believes in the sanctity of human life, but he's not a primary player anymore in bioethics. It's the secular bioethicists who are making the public policies and who are pushing futile care theory. And that if a patient or family doesn't believe in this, then under these protocols that are being put in place in hospitals all around the country, an ethics committee will decide behind closed doors whether that treatment shall go forward or not. And if that treatment is decided not to go forward, then even if you get another doctor willing to provide the care, the hospital can say no. This is something that is being pushed repeatedly in hospital after hospital. Some are saying no, some are saying yes. According to the articles I've read, it's being practiced in Houston, Texas, Des Moines, Iowa. I've heard about it in Detroit. I have a journal article here in my files from called the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics, which surveyed 26 California hospitals. 24 of them had futile care policies, and all but 7 of these gave the final decision about wanted treatment to somebody other than the patient. So what we are doing is we are returning to the kind of unilateral paternalism that used to mark the old problem where people were hooked up to machines against their will when they wanted to go home and die naturally, only now they're being told they can't have treatment they want. To put it polemically, it's like a hospital putting a sign that you might see in a restaurant over the door saying, we reserve the right to refuse service. There was just an editorial in the New York Times beginning to support this idea, because now the bioethics movement is, because they've got tons of money and they get grants from all the big foundations, and they're going around and they're going to start selling it to the newspapers to say, oh, well, yes, the doctor should make these decisions. The Des Moines Register editorialized and made that very point that these decisions should be the doctor's decisions. And I'll bet you if I went into the archives of the New England of the Des Moines Register, that when it came to pulling feeding tubes and people were saying you shouldn't pull a feeding tube from somebody because they've got a cognitive disability, the Des Moines Register said, no, it's choice. Who are you to interfere with a family, intimate family decision-making and family values? But now when somebody like that may want the feeding tube, the Des Moines Register says let the doctors decide.
Wesley, one of our listeners has emailed us, and they have this question. With a minute to answer, perhaps a little bit on the other side of the break, we've only got a minute before the break, Ruthie writes, how hopeful are you that America will return to a culture of life? I'm hopeful, but won't be surprised if physician-assisted suicide becomes the law of the land in a few years. What can we do to restore dignity to the living? 1 minute.
I'm hopeful we can stop it, because since 1994, we have stopped it. We have stopped it because we put together a diverse, strange bedfellow political coalition. You know, in 94, Oregon legalized assisted suicide and was expected to sweep the country. But now you've got pro-lifers standing next to the disability rights activists who tend to be pro-choice, standing next to hospice professionals, standing next to medical professionals, standing next to advocates for the poor, standing next to Catholics saying no. So we have created the kind of coalition that agrees to disagree about everything, maybe from the war in Iraq to abortion to gay rights or whatever. But on this issue, we steadfastly say no to killing, no to doctors being transformed from physicians, as one doctor I heard put it. He said, I'm a physician, I'm not an assassin. I thought that was a powerful sentence.
Wesley Smith is our guest, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. We're talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. When we come back, more of your email and a couple last questions. Is physician-assisted suicide medicine? And we'll talk about the confusion between pain care and euthanasia. What was it like to be a confessing Christian in Nazi Germany? What did Christians of conscience do when Hitler closed seminaries and silenced churches? How did German Christians react to the Jewish Holocaust? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with Pastor Paul McCain, interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House, based here in St. Louis. Paul, what's the current state of publishing, and Christian publishing in particular?
Well, with the economy the way it is, all publishing has been impacted by the downturn. And as I read the trade journals, it's interesting to note that many publishers are trying to identify ways to keep their prices down, even as their costs are increasing. The publishing industry is completely consumer-driven. You just have to walk into any large megastore like Barnes & Noble's, Borders, those types of stores to notice that. The Christian publishing industry faces very unique challenges. It's a large industry. A number of the largest publishers are publicly traded companies like Thomas Nelson. They do millions and millions and millions of dollars a year in business. I just recently read an interesting article in Publishers Weekly, which is kind of the trade Bible for the whole industry. And in the religion section, they point out that Christian publishers are most interested in meeting consumer demands for self-help books of all kinds. They say people would rather go to a bookstore than talk to their pastor, rabbi, or imam, and that's a big challenge.
So how is Concordia Publishing House different in the field of Christian publishing?
Concordia Publishing House exists to serve the publishing needs of our church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we believe that as we do, the best job we can possibly do in getting out materials that are faithful to the witness of the Lutheran Reformation, that we're not only serving our church, but also all Christians who find very appealing the message of Martin Luther, the great breakthrough of the gospel in the 16th century. The Lutheran Reformation is the oldest continuing evangelical movement in the history of the church, and it continues to this day, and we're very humbled by the opportunity we have at Concordia Publishing House to be what we believe to be the preeminent voice for the Lutheran Reformation in publishing in the English language. And all our materials strive to be faithful to God's Word and to our Lutheran confessions to get out clearly the gospel of Jesus Christ. We emphasize the teaching of the faith, how important it is to train people, to educate them, to inform them in the basics of Christianity. And all our materials, from Sunday school to academic books, strive to do that.
That's Pastor Paul McCain, interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House, based here in St. Louis. If you'd like a free catalog from Concordia Publishing House, call them at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit them on the web at www.cph.org, www.cph.org. Welcome back. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. Wesley Smith is our guest. You can purchase Wesley Smith's book, Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, at a 50% discount by calling Spence Publishing toll-free at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. Or you can order the book online at Spence Publishing's website. It's SpencePublishing.com, SpencePublishing.com. Wesley Inga writes from Toronto, saying this: having been in the situation of having to express my father's wishes to the doctors, thereby having to take an active part in his death, has been one thing I know now I can never, for which I can never be forgiven. I carried out my father's wishes, but I feel I lost my soul. I would never ask my children to do this. It is too much to ask. It's 10 years ago this year, and I still have not found forgiveness. I beg that you never ask anyone to carry out your wishes of mercy death. Is this a common response of people who have done this and realized the gravity of their actions?
Yes, I hear this quite often. I want to talk about the culture of life, too, that the other caller asked about, or the other email. It would depend on, first off, I think you're the pastor, but everyone can find forgiveness. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And so I would urge that in terms of her spiritual life, this caller realize she can be forgiven and is forgiven upon request, as if I understand my theology right, assuming she's a Christian. But it also depends on, let's take a look from a different aspect, and I would like you to address that issue just a little bit about forgiveness, because I really feel the woman's pain. It depends on what was done. If the relative said, listen, I don't want to be hooked up to machines, for example, the law says she has that right. Or if the woman said, I don't want to be on a feeding tube if I'm unconscious. Now, we might disagree with it. I've refused to do that for somebody who told me that's what they'd want and said they wanted me to be on the durable power of attorney for health care, and I told them, I'm sorry, I can't do that. If you put me on the durable power of attorney, I won't do that. And so I didn't get on the durable power of attorney. But I just think that people in that situation are put in such a position, especially today when doctors and nurses and chaplains even will be pushing people and pressuring people to pull plugs and to stop treatment, that one cannot blame oneself. You're in an extraordinary circumstance, especially if you're not forewarned and forearmed, which is one of the reasons I have put so much energy into this work and wrote Forced Exit. Most people are not aware of things like feudal care theory or these kinds of decision-making that may be required until the time comes. And they need to be aware so they can think ahead of time what's going on. And I would hope that this dear woman would find peace and find forgiveness and realize that in her own decision-making, you know, she shouldn't, as she said, ask for certain things to be done. But I would hope that a pastor or Todd, you could help her with the spiritual aspect of this, because we can all be forgiven, can't we?
Now, and I do want to address that, Wesley, especially if Inga is listening up there. This is the most important thing, and I say this not only to Inga, but to those who are listening who have in the past partaken in something like this. Two things. First of all, there is forgiveness. And it has been objectively purchased for you at the cross of Jesus Christ. It was there that he paid for all of my sins and Wesley's sins and Inga's sins as well. Even this one, he paid for them completely. And in his shed blood, there is forgiveness. Also, that forgiveness, which is ours in Jesus Christ, does not necessarily mean that having partaken in something like this in the past, we will not live with the regret over what we have done. And that's the struggle for the rest of one's life, to distinguish between the feelings of guilt, the regret, and the objective fact of having been forgiven because of Christ's shed blood at the cross. If you're wondering whether or not there's forgiveness, Jesus can answer that question for you. He says, I paid for that sin. If there is regret, well, sometimes regret is the consequence, not the punishment, and not the lack of forgiveness, but the consequence of these grave deeds. Wesley.
But also notice that by sharing that and confessing that, there may be somebody out there we'll never know about who will make the different decision now because they're forewarned and forearmed.
Wesley, here's a common confusion that I think people need to have explained. That is, palliative care. You mentioned hospice before.
Mm-hmm.
Pain control.
Right.
Sometimes the doses of, say, morphine, pain-controlling drugs, are so great that they appear to hasten the death of the person under hospice. Someone's going to say, well, what's the difference between that and euthanasia?
Well, that's what euthanasia advocates often say, because they're trying to confuse different concepts and vital distinctions. When you are in pain, let's say you have cancer. Cancer can be a very painful disease, as we all know. Strong pain-controlling drugs, sometimes called palliative drugs, palliation is to control pain, control symptoms, can control almost all cancer pain, or at least, if not eliminate it, certainly alleviate it. Now, it is a legitimate medical treatment to aggressively treat pain. We don't want people writhing in pain. Medical science has come to the place where very few, if anybody, ever has to be in that situation. We know how to control it or reduce it significantly. We don't do it well often, but that's a different story. If somebody accidentally dies as a side effect of getting legitimate medical treatment, that's not the same thing as euthanasia. And to prove it, let's take a look at a different legitimate medical procedure. Let's say you're on the operating table for heart bypass and you die. Would anybody say that the surgeon who was doing heart bypass surgery, in which the patient, as an unintended side effect of that surgery, died, had euthanized the patient? Absolutely not. No one would think that. Yet the same thing is happening if somebody accidentally dies from the use of strong medicine to control pain. It is no different than the heart situation, and it is not euthanasia any more than the heart situation is euthanasia. Moreover, strong pain-controlling medicine, when properly applied by a specialist who knows what they're doing, more often than hastening death, will actually increase the length of life, because all of that energy, you know, being in pain takes a lot of energy out of you. All of that energy that was going into being in pain can now go into living. And often the pain control specialists I've spoken with say that people with good pain control frequently live longer than they would have otherwise.
Now, you've raised the question here because you made the distinction between legitimate medical procedures, treatment, and what is done by the physician who assists in suicide. Is euthanasia the practice of medicine?
No, absolutely not. Killing is not medicine. And it's very easy to demonstrate example that kind of proves that. There was a woman named Diane Pretty in England. We spoke of her in the first hour, who was dying of motor neuron disease. And she filed a lawsuit in England to say, get a court order that said that if her husband assisted her suicide or killed her, that he would face no criminal prosecution or legal consequence. Now, her husband was not a physician. Notice that all of the euthanasia activists around the world jumped to Diane Pretty's case in support. Now, notice she also wasn't saying, don't prosecute my husband for practicing medicine without a license. She was saying he should not have to suffer the consequences of the criminal codes if he kills me or if he assists my suicide. That was not asking a doctor to do it. It was asking a non-doctor to do it. Can you imagine a lawsuit being filed where she said, let my husband do my appendectomy? It would be laughed out of court. Or if she said, you know, let my husband decide, a non-doctor, what kind of medicine should treat my motor neuron disease? Because those are legitimate medical treatments. We all know instinctively that killing isn't medicine. Jack Kevorkian killed people with carbon monoxide. Are we going to make carbon monoxide, which is like car exhaust, are we going to make that a palliative agent that should be covered by Medicare? Or take Switzerland. In Switzerland, there are assisted suicide groups that the government countenances, but none of them are doctors. And you now have suicide tourism where people are coming from the UK, for example, to commit suicide with the help of this group called Dignitas or some other group, and they're not doctors. That's not medical treatment. Killing isn't medicine. I once confronted a legislator here in California who had introduced a bill to legalize assisted suicide, and I pointed this out to her at a public forum. And she was very candid with me. She said, you know what, I would prefer to keep the doctors out of it. But for political reasons, we have to put them in. In other words, she was willing to subvert and pervert medicine in order to get her ideological law passed. But it wasn't because doctors, it's medicine. It's because she thought politically she needed the cover of medicine and the authority figure of the doctor to make it palatable for people to accept. So what's really going on is that the medical system and the medical profession is being subverted by this movement. And indeed, now in the Netherlands, I just read about a month ago, the Voluntary Euthanasia Society, now that they've got doctors killing just about anybody, you know, who they decide it's okay to kill, now wants to say, well, let lay people do it. Because they've got the Netherlands people now saying killing is acceptable, so now they want to start getting the doctors out of it.
We're talking with Wesley Smith about euthanasia and assisted suicide. When we come back from this break, we'll wrap up our conversation and, with a few last questions, find out what Wesley Smith has to say about a culture of life as well. Look at it this way. When was the last time you opened the paper and you read about a murder-suicide, an elderly couple found dead in their home? The husband had killed his wife, and then he had turned the gun on himself. Discovered that this was not a crime of passion or of hatred or of anger, but a so-called mercy killing. His wife was terminally ill, and he had already told his neighbors and his friends and his family that he could not stand to live without her. You say that should not happen. But if the husband were simply to have assisted in his wife's suicide and then went merrily on his way and not killed himself, there are people who say that should happen. Folks, they're both terrible tragedies and should not happen. When we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation with Wesley Smith. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In recent church history, one of the church's most vocal advocates has also been one of the church's most vocal critics. He lived and worked in Germany during the Third Reich. He died in a Nazi prison camp, executed at the order of Adolf Hitler himself. He was Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can read several columns written by our guest in this hour, Wesley Smith, on our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you're going to find these resources, issuesetc.org. Wesley, okay, is the legalization of physician-assisted suicide and these other kinds of assisted suicides, euthanasia, is it inevitable? It seems as though you could find a lot of people in polls who think it's a good idea.
Well, that's one of the, you know, biggest guns in the other side's arsenal, is this idea of it can't be stopped, it's the way of the world now, it's modern, etc. But, you know, for the last 9 years, since 1994, we have stopped it. And if you take a look at what's happened since Oregon legalized assisted suicide in 1994, Jack Kevorkian has been put in prison. The United States Supreme Court said no to a euthanasia Roe v. Wade. In other words, there was an attempt to have a constitutional right to assisted suicide imposed by the courts. And not only did the United States Supreme Court say no, but they said no 9-0, which doesn't happen very often. You had an initiative in Michigan where they knew something about assisted suicide because of Kevorkian in 1998 that failed by 71-29%, yet when it started in the polls, it was ahead in the 60s. In 2000 in Maine, you had an initiative that failed by 51-49% that started ahead in the polls in the 70s. The thing is that the more people learn about this agenda, other than a, you know, kind of like, just a belief system, you know, where you're not thinking deeply about it. But when you look at a real law and the real consequences and you focus, support for legalizing falls. It falls precipitously. But we are still in a close thing. It could go either way. Last year in Hawaii, they came within two votes of legalizing assisted suicide in the Hawaiian legislature, which was being driven by the then governor of Hawaii, who was a very enthusiastic proponent of euthanasia and had wanted to go out with a bang, meaning the legalization. At this time, that crisis has abated because there's a new governor. But, you know, every year there's something that pops up, and the way we will decide whether it goes that way or doesn't is going to be which side has the most energy and commitment. I'll be honest with you, most people in this country don't care about the issue one way or the other. They don't want to think about it. You don't see people marching in the streets in favor of euthanasia-assisted suicide. Jack Kevorkian was convinced that if he was put in jail, people would take to the streets demanding he be freed. He's become the nation's forgotten man. You know, people don't want to think about it. But there is a small group of people on both sides who are very energetically committed, and he or she with the most energy often wins the public policy debate. So I think it's whoever has the most commitment. Again, though, I worry the most right now about feudal care theory, because this is being snuck into hospitals behind closed doors, and most people don't know it's happening, and it's being promoted by groups and foundations with a lot of money. And at some point, there's going to be a test legal case. There have been cases about this that have gone both ways in the trial courts. They've never gone to the appeals courts. So we don't have a decision on that. We also have laws beginning to be introduced that would permit it, but, you know, most people don't know what their own legislatures are putting through. In California here, we have 1,000 bills a year. And the year they passed, we stopped the assisted suicide bill, they passed a statute that could be read to support feudal care theory. So it's going to take a lot of effort and commitment, and it's going to take people getting involved.
Now, you wanted to say something about, in connection with this, the culture of life. You had something more to say about that.
Yeah, a woman, one of the emails said, how do we do that? And the way we do that is each and every one of us commits to it. You look at the way Paul worked in the church, right? I mean, how did the church get started? How do people become Christians? It's because people care enough and commit enough to involve themselves in evangelizing people, sharing the good news, if you will. And look what happened. I mean, the entire nation, the pagan Rome, fell to the Christian movement, goodness gracious, in just about 200 years. The way we create a culture of life is to act in a culture of life manner and let people see what we're doing. And if they ask about it, we can explain it. I hearken it to like a rubber band. You know, let's say, Todd, we wanted to break a rubber band, and there were 20 of us. And I took the rubber band, I stretched it, and then I gave it to you, and you stretched it, and you gave it to Jeff Schwarz, your producer, and he stretched it. By the way, he's a great producer. Then you gave it to some of the people who've called in or emailed in, and eventually somebody broke it, right? Well, who would have broken that rubber band? It would have been all of us, right? Every one of us who stretched that rubber band before it broke added to the final breakage. And that's how we create a culture of life. A culture of death is being spread in the same way. And we just have to be more energetic, more committed, and willing to be not liked on occasion, because sometimes people get very upset with us. But if you're not willing to be not liked, you're not willing to do something important, it seems to me.
Wesley, you have 2.5 minutes. Make your case against euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide.
Euthanasia and assisted suicide is abandonment. It may not be meant to be abandonment by people who engage in it. But if you take a look at it, and you take a look how it works in the real world, that's precisely what it is. And it is a statement. If you are willing to kill somebody, or if you are willing to support the killing of somebody, you are making a very powerful statement that that is a disposable person, that that person is not as valuable or important as other people who you might not be willing to see commit suicide or be willing to kill. And that message gets out there. People begin to think of themselves, well, we had it on this show earlier. Well, if I became a burden, I should be killed. When did we come up with the idea that any of us is a burden? If we accept the concept of the human burden, and we turn to killing as an answer to that, if we accept the concept that a person who is ill or disabled doesn't have a dignified life, and that the answer is, quote, death with dignity, which is killing, then we have opened the door to a culture that will devalue increasing numbers of human lives. And rather than loving each other and compassionately caring for each other, we will have entered a time in which none of us in the end will be safe. Because if you can kill somebody who asks to be killed, as with feudal care, you can refuse to treat somebody who wants medical treatment based on the same reasons. In other words, oh, your life isn't dignified. Of course, if you want to die, I'll help you do it. Oh, your life isn't dignified. You want to live? I'm sorry, you can't do that. We're not going to give you that treatment. Are we going to tell our elderly relatives and loved ones they are burdens? Are we going to tell people who are disabled, yes, being dead is better than disabled, because that's the message they're receiving? Or are we going to turn to each other and find ways out of these very difficult issues that some have been addressed tonight in ways that enhance life, enhance community, enhance our intermingling and our existence as a forest instead of just a bunch of trees standing next to each other? Todd, how you die affects me. We're all in this together. We're not off on our own, and we're not isolated. And if we accept killing, I submit, as an answer to these issues, it's not going to stop with the sick, it's not going to stop with the dying, and it's not going to stop with people who are even older. I mean, look at what our kids are doing today.
We've got about 10 seconds here, Wesley.
We must turn to love, life, and compassion as the answer to these issues, not the coldness of the grave. That's not choice. That's the end of all choosing.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much again for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to help us defend life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc., call our resource line 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or you can write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Wesley's right. Assisted suicide, be it by a doctor's hand or someone else's, euthanasia is abandonment. Would you ask someone to abandon you? Here, while you're healthy and happy and living well? Would you ask someone to abandon you? You can take care of yourself now. Why in the world would you ask someone to abandon you when you can't take care of yourself? When you're helpless? When you need their help the most? You're not doing them a favor. You're asking them to do something they should never be asked to do. We abandon one another. And then we feel like it's our obligation somehow to ask others to abandon us. That is not the culture of life.